holding the ground. "Time to stop hiding," Drake said to Tolvern. "Get Cap on the comm. Tell her the situation. Make sure she doesn't kill our own guys when she comes in." Tolvern began speaking to Cap in a low voice as they proceeded cautiously down the hallway. The laboratories were bigger than expected, and it cost precious minutes going from room to room. They soon came upon a big room filled with refrigerator units, freezers, and rows of computers, microscopes, centrifuges, and other equipment. By now, Drake had a good dozen men and women in lab coats as prisoners. Some looked terrified, others indignant, even furious. None would give him the information he needed. One of the older technicians seemed to be in charge, or at least the others obeyed him when he ordered them to calm down. The man certainly looked the part of a lead scientist. He wore a lab coat and horn-rimmed glasses and had a shock of white hair with a high widow's peak.
"Let me try this again," Drake said when he had them all inside the large room. "I only need one thing and you can all go free. Where is the antidote? Is it in this room?"
The lead scientist frowned and shook his head as if confused.
"You keep saying that. We have no idea what you're talking about."
"The sugar antidote. It cures sugar eaters.
I know the Lord Admiral brought it here for study."
"We're doing nothing of the sort," the man said indignantly. "This is a legitimate research facility. We're breeding new strains of sugar cane that can handle the native toxins and poor soil in the highlands. An antidote? If such a thing exists, I've never heard of it, and neither has anyone else here."
"It came with the wreckage of the slaver. The pieces are lying outside. You know what I'm talking about."
"I have no idea why they hold that here, but it has nothing to do with us."
Drake was pretty sure he was lying.
"Then I'll try someone else. Tolvern, make an example of this man."
She forced the scientist to his knees, screamed at him to put his hands behind his head, and placed the barrel of her gun to his skull. The man stared straight forward. His face was pale, his lips pressed together, but he didn't volunteer information. Drake wasn't about to execute the man in cold blood, but he needed them to think he would.
"We'll need two more," he told Tolvern. "Three dead. That will show them we mean business."
Drake picked out a woman, also older, also with an air of authority about her.
"You, on your knees, unless you have something to tell me."
The woman dropped to her knees without a word.
"That one, too," Drake said, pointing to a younger woman with glasses who was trembling and pale.
Tolvern forced her to kneel next to the other two. Now both of the women were looking to the lead scientist, eyes wide and terrified. But none of the three spoke, nor did any of those still standing.
"You won't get anything from us," the leader said.
He lifted his eyes to Drake.
"None of us know what you're talking about. Whatever you heard, whatever you think you know, it's wrong."
Drake wasn't sure if the scientist was calling his bluff, or if the man truly didn't know. Either way, the response raised doubts. Could he be wrong? No, not unless the whole story of the sugar antidote were to unravel. Given enough time, he was sure he could break one of these people. But by now, Blackbeard would be lifting off, enemies would be coordinating their attack on Carvalho's men, and quite possibly, someone would have notified the destroyer and orbital fortresses of the attack on Admiral Malthorn's estate. He needed to get the goods and get the hell out. But before he could figure out a new angle, Nib Pym spoke up.
"Don't you see what your sugar has done to my race? It has enslaved 1 billion people and wrecked a great civilization. Is there not one of you with the conscience given to every sentient being? Is there not one man or woman who will help us find this cure to my people's misery?"
Drake winced. Nib Pym should have kept his mouth shut. The moral posturing would only backfire. Room outnumbered humans 10 to 1 on this planet, and no doubt the scientists and technicians had considered many times what would happen if the sugar curse were lifted from the masses who labored in the lowlands. All they had to do was look around. The estate was built atop an ancient Room temple. Anywhere you dug, you were likely to find the bones of their once proud civilization.
These scientists were the last people who could be expected to wish away humanity's greatest weapon in the struggle with the Hroom. For that matter, even Drake wasn't settled on the issue. He meant only to liberate the antidote from Malthorn and leave the troubling decision of what to do with the blasted thing for a later date.
"Excuse me. I can help you."
Drake turned toward the voice in surprise. The speaker was a solemn-faced young man, tall and slender. His accent, his fine cultured air, and the easy manner of his posture made Drake think he was of good breeding, if not of the landed gentry, then at least a young man with an education.
"Quiet, Brockett," the older scientist said. "You don't know what you're talking about."
"Yes, sir. I believe I do."
"Not another word."
"You'll find what you're looking for in the walk-in refrigeration unit on the right," the young man said.
"Damn you, Brockett."
"Get him out of here," Drake said, pointing to the older scientist. "As a matter of fact, get them all out of here, except for this one."
Tolvern and Smythe hustled the rest of the scientists out of the room at gunpoint. When they were gone, Drake turned back to the young man.
"They're gone, Mr. Brockett," he said. "Will you help me?"
The young scientist looked a little pale, but met the captain's gaze.
"I have two questions. What do you intend to do with it? And will you kill me when I give it to you?"
"I won't kill you. If I were that kind of man, I'd have started executing your friends when they wouldn't cooperate."
Drake forced himself to speak calmly, even as he felt the precious seconds ticking by.
"As for the other question, I don't know what I'll do with it, but I won't leave it in the Lord Admiral's hands. I don't know what Malthorn intends, but he means to use it for ill, you can mark my words. And if I can't find it, I will destroy this facility and everything in it."
"Will you give it to the Hroom?"
Here Drake hesitated and glanced at Nib Pym. "Not yet, no. I need to think about it. If I do share it with the enemy, it will be with conditions."
"You sound like an honest man," Brockett said. "My father always said that you can tell a gentleman because he will give you a straight answer."
"I do so when I can, Mr. Brockett," Drake said.
"Sir," the Hroom said, "may I offer my opinion?"
"Not now, pilot."
Cap came through on the comlink. "Captain, we're up. Titan fire. Can we come in yet?"
"1 minute, Ensign."
"But Captain..."
He ended the call. Every instinct was telling Drake to run, go, before the situation degraded. But there was something about the confidence in Brockett's comportment that told the captain that the young man wouldn't be bullied into handing over what he was demanding.
"Where is it?" Drake asked.
"I'll show you on one condition."
"I told you already. I don't know what I'll do with it, and I won't make any promises one way or another."
"Not that. My condition is that you take me with you."
Drake's eyebrows went up. "You don't even know who we are."
"I can guess. You're the one who destroyed the merchant ship, the rogue navy captain."
"I thought they were calling me a pirate now."
"They are."
The building shook from an explosion, and the lights flickered. Drake grabbed a nearby table to steady himself.
"The Lord Admiral will order me killed if I give you what you want," Brockett continued. "Anyway, I know things that can help you."
"About the antidote?"
"Yes, I can replicate it. I've learned the trick of it."
Drake didn't need to hear any more. "In that case, yes, please come. I give you my word, as a gentleman, whatever value that may hold given the current circumstances, that if you behave honorably and truthfully, you will be treated well." Brockett didn't wait for him to finish before he was rushing to the larger of the walk-in refrigeration units. He ordered Drake and Nib Pym to fetch 2 coolers from some cabinets on the far side of the room. When they returned, Brockett cleared off shelves in the refrigeration unit and tossed in vials of liquids and powders. By now, the building was shuddering from a series of explosions, and both Cap and Tolvern were frantically calling Drake on the comlink. He told Cap to come in for a landing, and Tolvern to release the scientists and meet him downstairs in the main lobby.
"Tell them to run," Drake said. "They won't want to be in the building when we get started on it."
Drake, Nib Pym, and the young scientist came into the hallway to find it filled with smoke. The sprinkler system came on and sprayed them with warm water. Nib Pym and Brockett each carried 1 of the coolers, while Drake cleared the way holding his rifle. He scared off the few workers they encountered and soon joined Smythe and Tolvern in the foyer.
Tolvern eyed Brockett.
Don't tell me he's coming with us.
It was a condition of his help. It seems Brockett would rather not face the Lord Admiral. She sighed.
Something wrong with your existing collection of sidekicks?
He didn't have time for banter. What is the situation?
Blackbeard has landed. She's giving them hell outside. Carvalho and his boys are still pinned down behind the wrecked slaver.
Good enough. Let's get out of here.
A wall of steamy, smoky air hit them as they burst outside. The stench of burning plastic and fuel oil filled their lungs and sent them coughing. The four men Drake had left to guard the perimeter remained ducked behind the wreckage of Henry Upton, uninjured but not daring to lift their heads and risk the fire blasting away across the open air. Thankfully, none of the gunfire seemed to be coming from the enemy, but that didn't make it any less hazardous. Blackbeard sat on a smoking stretch of the temple platform midway between the laboratories and the manor house. The burning wreckage of the helicopter lay on its side in front of the ship. Blackbeard's deck gun thumped at several enemies hunkered down at the estate. When it had suppressed that gunfire, it turned to blast at the laboratories.
"What the hell are they doing?" Drake said.
"Doesn't Barker know we were in there?"
Tolvern looked pained.
"I told him to do it."
"You did?"
"I wasn't sure you'd get the antidote, or that you'd get all of it, and I thought you said you wanted to burn it to the ground on our way out of here."
"Not while we were in it. Tell Blackbeard we're coming across."
Tolvern called in the order, and the deck gun swung around to attack the manor house again. Drake ordered the assault team forward. They ran, heads down toward the ship, hoping the deck gun didn't turn toward them. The staircase dropped to the scorched temple platform, and they scrambled up it. Bullets pinged off the side of the ship. Soon they were safely on board, with the staircase rising behind them and the doors closing. Moments after that, the ship lifted off the steaming surface of the planet. As Drake came running onto the bridge, he checked the viewscreen to see them climbing rapidly, the jungle swallowing Malthorn's estate below. Fire engulfed the laboratories, aided by the hot plasma ejection from the engines. A second, smaller column of smoke rose from the Lord Admiral's manor house. No missiles or gunfire chased after them. The deck gun kept pounding the complex until they'd climbed above the clouds and lost sight of the surface. Nobody shot at them, and Drake began to hope that they might reach deep space without further incident. One final run past the orbital fortresses, this one easier since they'd be accelerating instead of slowing their approach, and then they'd be safe. But they came up over the North Pole to discover two Navy warships lying in wait. One was the destroyer, HMS Javelin. The other was a corvette. The two ships must have been cruising the near space lanes a few hours earlier when Blackbeard made her approach and had come racing in to join the fight. They now lay side by side, next to the polar fortress, all batteries presented for an attack. Chapter 9. Drake stared at the enemy ships, frozen with indecision. Blackbeard could handle a single destroyer, and Drake was confident he could fight a destroyer and a corvette to a stalemate, hold them off long enough to make a run for it. He could accelerate faster than the destroyer and had a higher top speed than the corvette. If the corvette caught him before he could outrun her, she'd do so away from the destroyer's protective guns, and Drake could quickly settle matters. But he didn't dare lower his shields to give fight until he was out of range of that orbital fortress. Its guns overmatched anything that Drake could bring to bear, and it had enjoyed several hours to prepare for Blackbeard's return. As he fled the two warships in pursuit, the fortress would pound him with missiles, torpedoes, and cannon fire. He'd have sooner taken his chances against the Lord Admiral's battleship. At least Dreadnought would be one single enemy, not three. Drake forced confidence into his voice.
"Run us by the fort," he told Tolvern. "And straight on toward the destroyer."
"Yes, sir."
He could only pray that at least one of the enemy commanders would be incompetent, hesitate as he came in for the direct assault. Even then, he needed a whole lot of luck. Drake looked around the bridge, prepared to give a pep talk, but the confidence of his crew surprised him. Not one of them seemed to be panicking. Nib Pym worked at the nav computer, while Ensign Cap sent him numbers. Smythe, his hair still damp from the muggy drizzle of hot Barca,
sat at his station, fingers flying over the console. Manx assisted at the defense grid computer. Finally, Tolvern sat next to Drake, working her own computer. If she felt fear, it didn't show on her face. His heart swelled with pride to see them in action. He'd lost many of the highly trained crew who'd manned his bridge during the glorious victory at Kif Lagoon, but he'd take this band of misfits over them any day. Gunfire and missiles lashed at Blackbeard as she raced toward the destroyer. The direct approach kept her profile as narrow as possible and allowed Barker and Smythe to fight off a good portion of the attack with countermeasures, but the ship shuddered as they took a missile blast on the bow, and more cannon fire pounded them front and aft. Jane warned of more incoming fire, a torpedo circling in from behind, Class 2 detonation expected. Drake kept his straight approach as long as possible, in hopes that the destroyer would fear being rammed. Such a direct strike would be catastrophic, but more so for the more slender destroyer than Drake's cruiser. But the opposing captain seemed to recognize it as the bluff it was, and stayed in position, as did the corvette, both ships attacking mercilessly with cannon and missile. Blackbeard sheered to starboard at the last moment and threaded the gap between the destroyer and the orbital fort. It was a space of only 100 yards and extremely risky at these speeds, shuddering under enemy fire and the strain of escaping the planet's gravitational pull. But Tolvern, together with the pilot and subpilot, executed the maneuver perfectly, and they slipped through nearly unscathed. Unfortunately, the corvette had spotted the maneuver and was already accelerating to cut Blackbeard off and force her back into an open position against the guns of the destroyer and the fort. Drake's shields had already taken damage on that side, and he couldn't risk facing the corvette's guns. But neither could he risk circling the planet to flee in the opposite direction. The commanding officers of the other 5 orbital forts were no doubt licking their chops at the prospect of setting off their batteries against this insolent pirate cruiser that eluded them earlier. Some of those forts were monsters compared to this little one.
"Captain!"
Tolvern shouted. She pointed at the viewscreen. Fresh worry clenched at his gut. The screen showed yet another ship barreling in from space to join the fight. It looked like a missile frigate, midway in size between the destroyer and the corvette. She was coming at such an angle as to pincer Drake between the destroyer, the cruiser, and the fortress, where he'd face a devastating 4-way attack. He couldn't even return fire. He didn't dare bring down his shields. Missiles came zipping out from the frigate.
"Brace yourselves," Drake cried. "Jane, impact analysis."
His only hope, slim as that seemed, was to absorb the oncoming blow and escape in the chaos as the swiftly approaching frigate raced through the midst of the other ships.
"Class 3 detonation in 5 seconds, the computer voice said. She sounded remarkably calm, almost sedate.
Class 3? That was it? Was Jane drunk with a bottle of gin in some back-alley hard drive of the network? That was some computer malfunction that could downgrade all those missiles and torpedoes into a single Class 3 detonation. The back of the ship shuddered. That was a rear missile Jane had counted. The others she seemed to have missed entirely. He gripped the armrests and stared at his console. The schematic showed all shields intact, with only the rear panel blinking yellow against a sea of green. Any moment.
"Captain!"
Tolvern shouted. There was no panic in her voice. Only excitement. He looked at the viewscreen. The missiles streaked past Blackbeard and toward the 2 Royal Navy ships. The corvette launched countermeasures, but too late, and several of the missiles slammed into her bow. The final missile punched through the damaged shields, and a secondary explosion burst through the deck. The corvette broke off pursuit and limped away, venting debris and flaming gas. The frigate raced past them, engaged briefly with the destroyer, then wheeled and came in behind Blackbeard, as if to guard her flank. Drake stared, disbelieving. The frigate was helping him.
"Who the devil is that?"
"It's not Navy, sir,"
Smythe said from his tech console.
"Still analyzing her wake, but she seems like a Ladino craft."
"A pirate," Drake said wonderingly. It could only be. But who and why? He didn't wait to discover the identity of his mysterious benefactor, but ordered shields down and the main batteries deployed. They had reached a speed of almost 1,000 miles per second and were at the outer edge of effective fire from the orbital forts. He kept going another 40,000 miles, then pulled short and presented a broadside. The frigate veered off at an angle, then she, too, turned to present her main guns at the incoming destroyer. Javelin fired two more salvos at Blackbeard, then, eyeing the larger cruiser with the frigate in support, apparently decided that discretion was the better part of valor, and fled back toward the safety of the orbital fortresses. Drake turned his ship back toward deep space and punched it. The frigate was fast, and kept up the pace only a few thousand miles to their rear. She didn't fire, but her guns and torpedo tubes were still at the ready.
"Smythe," he said, "I need a name, an identity."
"Still working, sir."
"Hurry up, damn it. I need something."
Tolvern tapped at her console.
"Captain, the frigate has delivered a message."
"Yes?"
"Sending it through now, sir."
"Dear Captain James Drake, I bugged your ship before you left the San Pablo Yards. It is continually sending me subspace signal indicating your current whereabouts. It was a simple matter to track you to the Barca system, and I can find you wherever you go from here. You will follow me to the Seraphim system. If you do not, I will be forced to patch your signal to the Royal Navy, who has offered a rich bounty for your capture or death. If you fire on me, if you try anything treacherous, I will be delighted to let Lord Malthorn himself know of your whereabouts. C.V.
C.V.? He remembered the young woman standing behind Captain Vargas's shoulder on the bridge of Captain Kidd. Dark hair, flashing eyes. She'd worn a tight jumpsuit, unzipped to show the upper swell of her bosom, and a ruby pendant that dangled at the end of a necklace to lodge in her cleavage. Katerina Vargas. Tolvern had shot her father dead during the battle at the San Pablo Yards. Drake could only suppose that the daughter meant to seize his ship, and maybe his crew as well. Apparently, destruction at the hands of the Royal Navy hadn't been enough revenge to suit her taste.
"I've got it, sir," Smythe said. "The name of the ship is the Orient Tiger, a pirate frigate. Vargas's old warship before he sold it to buy Captain Kidd."
"Sold within the family, apparently."
"What does the message say?"
Cap asked. He ignored the sub-pilot. Tolvern had read it already, and he wanted her insight.
"Commander, what do you advise?"
"Better to fight her now than stumble into an ambush in the Seraphim system. Maybe follow her until we're sure we've lost those Navy ships, then turn on her and show her what's what."
"If we do that, she'll carry through with her threat."
"Soon as we wipe her out, we do a full scan for this bug," Tolvern said.
"Will someone tell us what's going on?"
Cap said.
"Not now, Ensign," Drake said. "Engineering already ran a full scan coming out of the yards," he said to Tolvern. "Whatever this is, it's well hidden."
"Please tell me you're not going to submit to her ridiculous demand," Tolvern said. "There's a trap on the other side of that jump, you know it."
"That was my first thought," he admitted. "But I'm reconsidering. She took a devil of a risk, tangling with the Royal Navy just so she could work her revenge in private."
"More than revenge. She wants your ship."
"Yes, I thought of that, too."
After another moment of thought, he shared Katerina Vargas's message with the rest of the officers on the bridge. Nib Pim made a humming noise, an indication of surprise for a Hroom. Cap took a moment longer than the others to decipher the note, but when she had, she drew in her breath.
"King's balls."
"Yes, quite," Drake said.
In all truth, he was intrigued, and more than a little grateful that Katerina Vargas had saved him from destruction. A few months ago, he would have dismissed her as another pirate lowlife, good enough for the gallows, but not much else. Now, he was willing to consider that her motives might extend beyond murder and plunder.
"Orient Tiger is changing course, sir," Smythe said, "and she's cloaking herself."
"Give me her plasma signature and I can follow,"
Nib Pim said.
"So long as we stay within a few thousand miles, we'd better hurry, though."
Interesting. So the Hroom wanted to follow and see what Vargas wanted. He was usually more cautious than that. And then Drake saw the reason. The Seraphim system had easy jump points into the Hroom Empire. go to Seraphim, and Nib Pim would be a good deal closer to his ultimate goal of disseminating the sugar antidote. Drake made a decision.
Raise shields? Full cloaking? We're going to follow this pirate and find out what she wants.
Chapter 10 Apex will kill you all. What the devil did it mean? Captain Rutherford had been puzzling over the phrase since hearing the captive spit it out. The room had raved, fighting his restraints, threatening, begging for sugar to eat, everything in short but providing more information, only that one phrase. A threat? A warning? Apex. Rutherford had tried for several more minutes to get through to the prisoner, but eventually gave up and went back to the bridge to see if any more information had come through from the fleet. Harbreak called to discuss repositioning their ships against possible attack, and when that call ended, Pittsfield told him that Catherine Cates wanted to speak with him. Rutherford had sent the young lieutenant and her torpedo boat to investigate the wake of the ship that had presumably destroyed the two room vessels. Perhaps she had new information. Rutherford took the call in the war room. He put Cates on the screen. She had a proud, confident air to her, and her eyes were the hazel color with green flecks, common to the upper classes of the Zealand Islands. In fact, she reminded him a little of Helen Drake, James Drake's younger sister. Helen was as pretty a girl as one could imagine.
"Have you found anything?" he asked.
"Yes, sir, I followed the wake. The ship that left it has jumped out of the system for parts unknown."
"Parts unknown? You mean she jumped back to San Pablo, don't you?"
"No, sir, the ship left via a different jump point."
"That isn't possible, Lieutenant. The closest jump point must be 200 million miles from here."
"They left via a temp point, sir. It's already degrading." "Good heavens, a temp point." That was even more implausible. It was not uncommon to come across a temporary jump point, an unstable rift in space that would open to some distant point and then degrade within a few days or weeks. But nobody would jump into such a thing, not willingly, not until it had been charted, and temp points rarely stuck around long enough to chart. Go through, and you might find yourself somewhere unpleasant, within the corona of a star, say, or next to a neutron star, or nowhere at all. Pop out into the void 3 light-years from the nearest star, with no other jump points in sight, and the temporary point collapsing behind you, and then what?
"Thank you, Lieutenant." Rutherford let the skepticism color his voice as he prepared to end the call. "Send your data to my pilot."
"I already did, sir, or rather to Calypso's pilot. He was a classmate of mine at the academy, and I asked if he'd look it over before I called. I didn't trust my findings, as you can imagine. I wanted to be sure."
"Yes, well." Rutherford didn't know if he should be pleased with her initiative or annoyed at the breach of protocol. Perhaps a little of both.
"He confirmed that it's a temporary jump point. It's already decaying, and he estimates it will be gone in less than 5 hours. And that's not the half of it."
Cates hesitated, and Rutherford had the impression it was for dramatic purposes, not because she was uncertain.
"My instruments were showing a subspace channel."
"What do you mean?"
"For sending subspace messages. You know the channels we open to communicate with the fleet. They're wide enough to send through a stream of atoms. A subspace channel is a jump point of sorts, only very small."
"I know the science," he said peevishly. "But what does this have to do with the temporary jump point you claim you detected?"
"Because I followed the wake of the mystery ship, and it ended where I was detecting the subspace channel. It isn't a subspace channel. It only looks like one. It's a full-size jump point. An artificial jump point."
Cates sounded more than a little smug at this revelation. No wonder that she would be. If such a thing were true, it would be revolutionary. Neither Albion nor the Hroom Empire possessed the technology to force open a jump point big enough to send through a physical object larger than a stream of atoms, not so much as a miniature probe, never mind an entire ship. The ramifications staggered him. It took tremendous resources to catalog the ever-shifting natural jump points, and those jump points occurred irregularly and in generally inconvenient places. But imagine a ship that could manipulate space wherever it wished and pop up wherever it wanted.
No more long slogs from one jump point to the next. Such a ship would travel like a stone skipping across a pond and cross the entirety of charted space in a few days, one jump after another. Rutherford was still digesting this information when Cates cleared her throat. "Will that be all, sir?"
"What? Oh, yes. Well."
Rutherford peered into the screen at this confident young woman.
"Where are you from, Lieutenant?"
"Albion, sir. West Canada, the coast opposite the Zealand Islands."
"I thought you might be. I can hear it in your accent. Who was your father? A gentleman, I presume?"
"Yes, sir. My grandfather owned a prosperous estate, and my father's eldest brother inherited it. Perhaps you've heard of him, Sir Reginald Cates."
"Yes, I have."
"My father is not so prosperous as my uncle, but he received a small inheritance from his maternal side that was sufficient for our needs. I enjoyed a proper education."
"I thought so. Your good breeding is apparent. How old are you, Cates?"
28, sir."
"That old? With such initiative, I'd have expected you to be commanding more than an 8-man torpedo boat by now."
"Generally, the accusation is that I have too much initiative, sir. I was first mate of an Alliance-class corvette, but I ran afoul of my captain."
"Who was your captain?"
"Heartbreak, sir."
"Ah, yes. I'd forgotten he was on a corvette. Perhaps he didn't fully appreciate your qualities, Lieutenant. Send me your data about the jump point. I will call you if I have questions."
He ended the call. At first his thoughts lingered on Catherine Cates, not so young as he had presumed, old enough to be better positioned within the fleet, given her background and abilities. Never mind serving on Nimitz as Harbrake's commander, she could be captaining the vessel instead of him. Rutherford had little use for the cautious, overbearing man, except that he was Admiral Mouthorn's pet. Better to have a woman of initiative, like Catherine Cates. But Rutherford's thoughts quickly turned to the artificial jump point. What were the Hroom about, first destroying two of their own ships with a new weapon system, and then showing off their ability to create a jump point out of pure vacuum? Did they mean to intimidate Albion into calling off the war? What they didn't expect, he guessed, was for anyone to follow them through. After all, what fool would stumble blindly through a temporary, rapidly decaying jump point? But if Cates was right, that jump wouldn't lead to a black hole or the empty void of space. It would go somewhere useful. No doubt, one of the planets at the heart of the Hroom Empire. Rutherford thought briefly about sending a message to the Admiralty, but instinct told him to hold this close to his chest until he was sure of what he was facing. He came back onto the bridge and eyed Commander Pitsfield. No sign of Lieutenant Billings, the second mate, and one of Malthorne's loyalists, foisted off on Rutherford during the wholesale crew replacement on Albion a few weeks ago. Billings had been in the sick bay since coming out of the jump. Seems like he suffered the trips every single jump. Worthless fool. Cates had sent the requested information by the time Rutherford took his seat. He looked it over, and was shortly satisfied that she'd given him an accurate summation of the situation.
"Captain," Pitsfield said, "we've got a subspace from HQ. There's trouble in the Barca system. We have new orders."
"What kind of trouble?" Rutherford asked with a frown. "Empire forces?"
"It's not the Hroom, sir. It's Captain Drake. He's fleeing the system and the Navy is rushing forces to intercept him. We are ordered to join the hunt."
Rutherford wanted nothing more than to race back and face his old friend in combat, preferably one-on-one, vigilant against Ajax, or whatever Drake's old ship had become since her overhaul in the San Pablo yards. Attacking Drake with an entire task force would hardly be a fair fight. But he had bigger worries now, worries the Admiralty knew nothing about. Finding out what was on the other side of that jump point was of far greater importance than hunting down a single rogue Navy captain and his crew of pirates, freed prisoners, and mutineers. Drake was an annoyance, more of an affront to Malthorn's ego than a threat. Rutherford read the official order, which was rather strangely worded, as such things went. Flag Officer Rutherford. At 09:24 hours, November 27, 2630, the traitor James Drake attacked naval resources outside Hot Barca and led a ground assault team that killed many civilians and destroyed much property. Drake escaped before he could be intercepted and is now fleeing the system. He must be stopped at all cost. This will take priority over engagement with Empire forces. You will proceed to the Griffin Shoals via the San Pablo Fantalus route. Leave Calypso, 2 destroyers, and a missile frigate at San Pablo. Leave Richmond and 3 torpedo boats at Fantalus. Proceed with Nimitz to the Griffin Shoals. You will receive new orders as information becomes available. With resolution, Vice Admiral Thomas Lord Malthorn. That explained the curious way the orders were worded. They seemed to come directly from the Lord Admiral himself, and not the staff officer normally tasked with such things. How odd. Then Rutherford remembered that Malthorn had extensive holdings on Hot Barca. Was that what was behind Drake's assault? A personal vendetta against the Lord Admiral for his role in stripping Drake of his commission and sentencing him to hard labor? And was Malthorn's response a similar act of vengeance? Because it beggared understanding that the Navy would be rushing resources to track down the man when it had just initiated a new war with the Hroom Empire. Pittsfield interrupted Rutherford's musings.
"I've relayed orders to prepare all ships for a return jump. I gave Harbrake 30 minutes to complete his investigation of the destroyed Hroom warship. Perhaps he can find something useful before we go.
Belay those orders. Pass this message in its place. Harbrake will leave at once. Nimitz will proceed through the jump as the flagship, with Harbrake in command of the task force.
Sir?
We are staying behind.
Not staying behind so much as setting an immediate course for that temporary jump point, to squeeze through before it decayed further and broke apart. They would emerge, God only knew where. It was dangerous, but Rutherford counted the secrets that lay on the other side as absolutely necessary to the prosecution of the war and perhaps even to Albion's long-term survival against the Empire. But he didn't say this part aloud, let the crew digest one bit of difficult information at a time. He waited for Pittsfield to finish passing along his orders.
"One more thing, Commander. There's a lieutenant on a torpedo boat who has provided some valuable intelligence and showed initiative and energy. I want her brought on board before the fleet departs. Her name is Cates, and her boat is attached to Nimitz."
"Yes, sir."
"And I need that groggy fool in the sick bay sent over to Nimitz. Billings. He has important intelligence for Captain Harbrake."
"What kind of intelligence, Captain?"
"The intelligence that Billings' worthless hide has been replaced as second mate of HMS Vigilant by Lieutenant Catherine Cates."
Chapter 11. Commander Tolvern was surprised to receive an invitation from Captain Drake to dine with him in his cabin. Were it to become known, the mere existence of such an invitation would set tongues wagging, caps and carvalhos at the very least, so she determined not to mention it to anyone. Why would Drake allow such a rumor to be started, unless he were oblivious that bringing her to dine would suggest something improper? And then it occurred to her that maybe he really did mean something improper, that he'd invited her to his room with the intention of... That's ridiculous. Put it out of your head. Nevertheless, Tolvern took extra care with her appearance before going to his room. She showered, slicked back her short hair, even put on a bit of lipstick, a very small bit, and changed into a freshly laundered uniform. She had a bottle of perfume she'd been keeping since her last shore leave on Albion, and she opened it and took a whiff. That was strong. On second thought, she returned it to the shelf. The smell of soap and clean skin would have to suffice. Drake was out of uniform when he greeted her at the door, wearing comfortable trousers with a drawstring and a white linen shirt open at the cuffs and throat. He looked her over.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Aren't you off duty? If this is a bad time..."
"It's a great time," she said hastily. "I wasn't sure if you wanted to talk operations, what with the jump coming and all."
"No, it's just dinner. The less we talk about military business, the better."
"I'll go back and change."
Tolvern was thinking again about the perfume. Wouldn't hurt to put on a dab when she was in her room.
"Give me 5 minutes."
Drake took her arm before she could turn away. "Come on in, you're fine, dressed as you are." Inside, a delicious smell hung in the air, like beef and mushrooms and frying onions, and her stomach rumbled. She forgot her embarrassment and followed Drake to the kitchen, where he stirred something delicious and creamy on the stove. He pulled a loaf of bread from the oven and set it steaming on a cutting board.
"When did you learn all this?" she asked. "Doesn't Drake Manor have an army of cooks?"
"Why do you think I learned?" he said with a smile. "The food in the Navy was so bad in comparison that I knew I'd be forced to cook my own food if I ever wanted a decent meal again. Here, make yourself useful and put together this salad, assuming you know how to cook, that is."
"Please, my father is your father's steward. Our entire staff consisted of one maid and one deaf old man who used to come around to help in the garden. We prepared our own meals. I learned to cook before I could ride a bicycle."
Tolvern reached for the knife to cut the tomatoes as she said this and wasn't paying attention. The knife slipped from her grasp and clattered to the ground, making Drake dance back to avoid the falling blade. She bent for it, blushing furiously. Drake raised an eyebrow.
"And are toes one of the things you learned to cook?"
"Sorry, sir, sorry."
"It's fine, no, wash it off first."
Another blush.
"Sorry, Captain, I got flustered."
"Would you mind very much calling me James?" Her heart fluttered.
"No, sir, I mean, James, sir."
She winced. What an idiot. He laughed.
"I know it's improper. Your father started calling me Mr. James Drake from an early age, and I suppose Mr. Drake would be fine if we were still back home. But after so long as your captain, that would sound even stranger to my ears. I don't mean you to start calling me by my given name all the time, but I need this pressure off my shoulders, and you're the only one I can count on as a friend. So, just for tonight?"
"Of course, and you can call me Jess."
She hesitated.
"Just for tonight, naturally."
"Jess, certainly."
"Or Jessica. That's my full name. That's what my family still calls me. No, wait. Jess is fine. Now I'm babbling like an idiot."
He smiled. "Tell me something interesting about yourself, Jess."
"Like what?"
"The usual stuff people talk about in situations like this. Are you reading anything at the moment? What was your favorite subject at the academy? What are your sisters and your brother doing these days?"
With such a ridiculous prompt as that, she didn't think there was any way she'd be able to talk to him. But after a tentative start, she was off and running. As she helped him set the table, it occurred to her that she was still babbling, that he was saying very little in return, so she asked him a couple of polite questions. He answered briefly, and then she found herself jumping into the silence and chattering on again. As soon as she realized this, it was like someone had glued her mouth shut. She could no longer think of a single thing to say that he might find interesting.
"Damn it, can't you act normal? How is your family?"
she asked, then forced herself to stay quiet long enough for him to answer.
"I wish I knew, but I don't dare contact them. I imagine my parents are worried sick, if not my sisters too. I imagine your family is worried too."
"I sent a message, not from the ship, of course," she added hastily, "from San Pablo."
"Be careful, someone might still intercept it."
"It was just before we left. I wouldn't have put us at risk, you know that."
"I'm more worried about the risk to your family. You don't want them associated with your actions, not now."
"You don't think they'd hurt our families, do you?"
Tolvern asked.
"Probably not. But I'd rather not put it to the test. My sister Madeline married just last year, and her husband is a lieutenant in the Third Fleet. They seem to be hoping my name would help his career. They're disabused of that notion by now, I'm sure."
Tolvern had pleasant memories of the older of the two Drake girls, who was about her own age. Madeline had been a cheerful, friendly girl, and never looked down on the steward or his family. A good friend. She had taught Tolvern how to ride, and kept a roan mare just for her friend to use. Tolvern didn't know the younger sister, Helen, nearly so well, but had the impression that she was bright and pretty, and beloved by the rest of the family.
"What is Helen doing?" she asked. "Is she going to the academy? She seemed clever enough."
"More than clever, she's the brightest of any of us."
"She plays chess, doesn't she? My father was telling me she's really good."
"A little too good. I was the one who taught her, but by the time she was 14 I could no longer defeat her."
He smiled as if thinking of some specific memory. "But I don't think Helen will go to the academy. Her ambitions are more limited, like my mother's."
"Don't tell me she wants to stay on Auckland," Tolvern said. "There's a big universe beyond that little rock."
"I don't know. Helen is curious enough about the outside world. She practically lives in my father's library.
but she has no real desire to travel. I think she'd be satisfied marrying a gentleman of intellect and good humor, who possesses some means, and then raising a dozen children with him.
Seems a waste, but I suppose Albion needs women like that too.
So says the crown, anyway, Drake said. If we're to fulfill our so-called destiny, we can't be taking all of the clever women and sending them to the academy. The king calls it skimming the cream.
It seemed unfair to Tolvern that this should be the case. Nothing stopped a man from having a family and a navy career at the same time, but put a woman in the navy, and suddenly the paths to domestic happiness closed off for her. She couldn't fraternize with her fellow officers, and unlike what a male officer enjoyed, when she returned planetside to Albion, there would be no balls set up to introduce her to handsome single men. So what should Tolvern have done? Stay in her father's house, waiting to be courted by some young bachelor with prospects? Such men did not always materialize. She had two unmarried aunts who seemed reasonably attractive and well-spoken. One had moved to Cardiff to make her own way in life, while the other had waited and waited and waited to be courted. Neither had married. But one woman's life seemed particularly circumscribed, as if she were still waiting now in her 40s for that suitor to arrive. Not that Helen Drake ran any risk of that sort of outcome. The captain's sister was young, pretty, and the daughter of a baron. Any man would find her a prize worth pursuing. The privilege of class and rank, Tolvern supposed. The food was ready and they ate. It was quite good. Maybe not like a fine restaurant in Yorktown, but better than navy slop, that was for sure. Of course, it helped that the captain had access to higher quality ingredients than they stocked in the ship's kitchen. "Thank you for that," Drake said when they'd finished. "I hope it wasn't improper to ask you to dinner. I didn't want you to feel uncomfortable." He rose, and she rose with him. "Not at all," she said, thinking he was on the verge of dismissing her.
"Would you care for some dessert?" She quickly sat back down.
"I'd love some. What did you make?"
"Fruit tartlets. I got frozen blackberries on San Pablo. Cost me a fortune, as you can imagine, and I didn't want to just eat them plain." He hesitated. "I'm not sure how they turned out since I substituted honey for the sugar."
"I'm sure they'll be great, James."
Drake brought out two individual pastries, together with a bottle of port, which he used to refill their wine glasses. The tart blackberries reminded her of scouring the bushes that grew on the edge of the estate, where pasture became forest. Tolvern and her sister would go foraging, filling their buckets and their bellies at the same time. They'd come home with stained fingers and scratches on the back of their hands. Eating blackberries so many light years from home brought a twinge of nostalgia.
"Could have turned out worse, I suppose," he said. "But that honey flavor adds a strange element."
"It's delicious."
The port was combining with the wine already in her belly to make her light-headed and less tightly wound than earlier. Also, perhaps, a little reckless. A calm, rational voice deep in her head told her to shut her trap, that she was borderline drunk and would regret that reckless feeling later, perhaps deeply. She ignored the voice.
"It must be hard being captain," she said, "feeling apart from everyone else."
"Sometimes." He seemed to look past her shoulder, eyes growing unfocused.
"Yes, you could say that."
"You look like you're remembering something."
"Yes, as a matter of fact."
A wry smile.
"An old girlfriend."
"You had girlfriends?"
"You sound shocked. Yes, I had one girlfriend, anyway. We met the summer before I went into the academy."
"I don't suppose it was anyone I know. Some earl's daughter, no doubt."
"Actually, no. That's why we aren't together. I think you might know her. Marianne Elliot."
Tolvern blinked.
"Mary Elliot? She was my sister's best friend growing up."
"Yes, I know. That's what my father kept reminding me. Classmate of his steward's daughter. Her father a shopkeeper and her mother a hospital nurse. Marianne Elliot was hardly a high-born lady. Not fit to be a match for a baron's son. Even a baron with such minor holdings as my father's."
Tolvern was surprised at the turn of jealousy deep in her gut, and she fought it down. Why should that matter to her? She had nothing against Mary Elliot or her family. Mary had been a pleasant girl, reasonably attractive,
and with a bright, sparkling wit. Strong-willed and fiercely ambitious, given where she'd started in life.
"Rather funny thing," Drake said. "Did your sister tell you what became of Mary?"
"Went to York after finishing her studies. That's the last I heard. After that?"
Tolvern shook her head. "Mary borrowed a sum of money and started a business. Got involved in politics after the parliamentary crisis. There's word she's going to stand for a position in the House of Commons next year."
"Really? Then I guess your father would really disapprove now. Your grandfather was in the House of Lords, wasn't he?"
"Not so fast," Drake said with a smile. "Mary must have made a fortune in the trades, or she couldn't afford to stand for Parliament. We're a small barony, barely solvent. Money would trump breeding, and even politics, in my father's eyes."
"Then you still think you might..."
"What? No, that ship has sailed, as the old saying has it. She married a gentleman from Britain. They have a child together."
"Oh, I'm sorry. But surely there are other prospects for a man of your breeding and accomplishments."
"I have had none," she scoffed.
"I can't believe that."
"It's my own decision, of course. I haven't put myself in the proper situations. Balls and dinners on Albion, I mean. I was busy, and not given to seeking temporary company in distant ports, as some are wont to do. Of course I have the same desires as any other man."
"However?"
Drake gave an affected shrug. "The Navy has been my lover."
"She's a fickle mistress."
"Yes, quite." He drank the last of his port, and not nearly so warm in bed as a woman.
Tolvern glanced at her empty glass and wished she'd had one more drink to steel her courage. The captain had loved a commoner. He had expressed his loneliness, his desire to share pleasure with a woman. James Drake was a man lacking in artifice. She did not think he had invited her here with the intent of seducing her. Nevertheless, here she was, and the opportunity was full in her hands to press herself upon him. Would he refuse her if she made a move?
"Enough of my troubles, Commander Tolvern."
"Jess," she reminded him. "We were going to use proper names tonight, remember?"
"Yes, sorry. Jess. Old habits, you understand, quite difficult to shift one's preconceived understanding of a person." That punctured her courage.
"Yes, true. Well, I suppose I should be going."
"I'm sorry that didn't come out very well. I've always thought highly of you, of your family. What I meant is that I see you as an officer, my very competent second in command, and it's unusual to see you on a private basis, even one so harmless as this. I hope I didn't offend you just now."
"Of course you didn't," she said quickly. "I understand perfectly what you meant and what you didn't mean. It's just that I'm on my last sleep cycle before the jump, and I want to come through well rested. Thank you for a most excellent meal and for the conversation. I would be happy to do it again whenever you need company."
"There is one thing you could do for me before you go back to your rooms," Drake said. "Ensign Cap is also off shift. Could you take her to the mess and buy her a drink?"
"Now?"
"Yes, I know you're tired, but could you?"
"First dinner with the captain and then drinks with the sub-pilot," she said in a light tone. "That's a lot of fraternizing for one night. Anyway, I'm not sure another drink would be a good idea. I'm rather light-headed as it is."
"A cup of tea, then. It's not for the sake of camaraderie. I need information, and I think you're the best person to dig for it. Seems you and Cap formed a rapport in San Pablo, a friendship of sorts."
"I wouldn't go that far. More like a cordial partnership."
Tolvern hesitated.
"What kind of information do you need?"
"Barker has completed a full scan of the ship. He insists there is no bug, no tracking device on board. Nothing sending out an illicit signal. Could be that he's mistaken, that one of Rodriguez's engineers buried an object deep in the hull when we were in the yards for repairs, but Barker is absolutely confident. The alternative is that Katerina Vargas lied to me, that she found us in the old-fashioned way. Someone told her how to find us. He's still telling her."
"And do you think it's Cap?"
"Not necessarily. Forced to hazard a guess, I would say one of the pirates we picked up on San Pablo. But they were recruited by Cap and Carvalho, who may know something. I trust Cap more than her lover, and so there you have it. Will you talk to her?"
Yes, of course. But I thought you'd decided to meet with the pirate's daughter anyway.
I have, yes. I'm curious. And it's a good way to stall Nib Pym about this antidote thing.
The scientist from Hot Barsa, this Noah Brockett fellow, he's all set up in the lab?
Getting there, Drake said. It won't be long.
Tolvern circled back to Cap. But I guess you'll want to find out anyway. Be helpful to know what Katerina Vargas does or doesn't know, regardless of what she tells us when we get there.
Exactly.
In that case, sure, I'll talk to Cap. I don't fully understand the woman, but I know she won't turn down a free drink.
Tolvern rose to her feet.
Thanks again for the dinner, James.
You are more than welcome. But I suppose we should go back to Captain and Commander now. Wouldn't want people to get the wrong idea.
No, I guess we wouldn't.
Tolvern felt deflated as she walked to the lift. How was it that she felt more lonely now than before she'd had dinner with the captain? He had been accommodating, friendly, complimentary. And he hadn't invited Barker to dinner or Nib Pym. She was the one he'd chosen to open up to. So why was she so down? Because there's no pretending any longer, that's why. There it was. Her heart had leaped when Drake confessed his loneliness. Was he, could he possibly be talking about her? She'd been so willing to throw herself on him, and so embarrassed when it was clear that, no, he hadn't been even slightly interested, that it was impossible any longer to avoid the obvious.
"I'm in love with the captain," she whispered to herself as the lift doors closed with her inside. How ridiculous was that? She may as well have been a child daydreaming in the back of the class about her father's young master and doodling on her notebook, Lady Jessica Drake, with a big heart around it.
But he'd fallen in love with Marianne Elliot, hadn't he? She was a commoner, too, and not so beautiful or accomplished, well, back when it happened, that it was impossible to imagine him doing it again. There was the small matter of fraternization, of course. Captain Drake's opinion on that subject was well known. Tolvern looked first in the mess, supposing that Cap was already at the bar, drinking and carousing with her friends, but she was not there. A couple of quick calls confirmed that Cap was not on the bridge either, nor in engineering or the gunnery. She must be enjoying the solitude of her room, perhaps even napping off schedule, and so Tolvern made her way to the officer berths above the bridge. She knocked gently.
"Yeah, who is it?"
came Cap's low York accent from the other side of the door.
"It's me, Tolvern. You have a minute?"
"Important, is it?"
"I wouldn't have come to your room if it weren't. Can I come in?"
"Sure, I don't mind, except I'm lounging in my underwear."
"If it bothers you, then pull on some pants already."
"Don't bother me if it don't bother you."
The door opened and Tolvern stepped inside. It closed behind her.
"Actually," Tolvern said, "if you want to get dressed, I'll treat you to a drink in the mess. I haven't used all my rations."
As she said this, her eyes adjusted to the dim light, and she saw that Cap wasn't alone. The woman stretched, feline-like, along her bed, wearing nothing but panties and a camisole that barely contained her straining breasts. Carvalho sprawled behind her, his back pressed against the wall so he'd fit on the narrow bed. A sheet covered him to his waist, but it left exposed his lean belly and his muscular chest with its dark, curly hair.
"Normally that would sound pretty good," Cap said. "I ain't the sort to turn down a free drink, you know that. But I'm not sure I want to get up as of yet."
"You have company,"
Tolvern said stupidly.
"Aye, but you don't mind, do you, love?"
Carvalho smirked his answer.
"She can join us if she wants."
"Shut up, you!"
Cap slapped his chest playfully.
"And put your pants on, she don't want to see you hanging out. Make room."
The room was only a few feet wide, and barely long enough for a bed and a toilet. The air was close with the musky smell of love-making. Tolvern wished she could simply melt through the door and back into the corridor.
"We'll talk later. It's not important. Really, no,"
Tolvern said to Carvalho as he sat up and grabbed for his underwear at the foot of the bed.
"Don't trouble yourself."
She slapped open the door and fled into the hallway before she could see any more. The sight of Cap and Carvalho together on the bed, the scent in the room, his muscular body. It was all too much. Tolvern sent Drake a quick message as soon as she reached the safety of her room. Cap, she explained, had been in her room and not inclined to go out. Let the captain parse that sentence for meaning. But, Tolvern added, she would approach Cap again as soon as it was possible. Message sent, Tolvern undressed for bed. Her mind was still churning, her head light from the wine and brandy, as she turned off the lights and crawled under the sheets. She thought about the captain, remembered Carvalho, lying half-naked in bed. She was simultaneously horrified and aroused. Sleep was a long time coming. Chapter 12. Drake followed the pirate ship warily through the jump point. He emerged stunned on the other side, half expecting to find himself under attack from a motley fleet of pirate vessels left lurking there by Katerina Vargas in anticipation of his arrival. If he didn't think his shields strong enough to weather a barrage, and his engines powerful enough to quickly outrun any subsequent pursuit, he wouldn't have risked it, the woman's threats notwithstanding. As it was, there was nothing on the other side but Orient Tiger, Katerina Vargas's pirate frigate, and she'd already set course and begun to accelerate. No hiding this time. Vargas apparently felt secure enough in the system to travel uncloaked, but not so secure that she wanted to linger in front of the jump point to see whatever ships might be following them through. Drake followed her for another 7 hours, passing through an asteroid belt, before Orient Tiger slowed and eventually came to a stop within the ring of moons surrounding a purplish gas giant. There was a small mining colony on one of the moons, but Vargas seemed to know this as well and kept herself shielded from the moon on the far side of the planet. The pirate frigate hailed Blackbeard, and Drake opened a channel on the viewscreen. Katerina Vargas appeared. She wore her leather vest partly unzipped, and the ruby pendant, which glowed blood-red, throbbing under the reflected light of her console. Vargas smiled, and didn't look at all upset to see Drake on the other side. "James Drake, the man who killed my father."
"That was never my intention."
"Perhaps not. But it was inevitable when you pursued Captain Kidd and demanded her cargo. If you'd known my father at all, you'd have known that he would have never capitulated to such blunt tactics, that he'd have fought back, and when defeated, would have come seeking revenge." It was the first time Drake had heard the woman's voice, and his first thought was surprise that she sounded so cultured, not like her father's rough way of speaking. If he closed his eyes, he'd have thought her a lady from southern Britain, a woman of education and breeding, perhaps accomplished as a singer given the smooth tone of her voice. Yet she so clearly looked like her father, with her bronze skin and flashing dark eyes. Only with better effect. She was a beautiful woman and seemed to know it.
"If you've come for revenge, you'll be quickly disabused of that hope," he said.
"Revenge?" Vargas laughed, and the sound was without malice. "No, I would thank you, if the circumstances were otherwise. Look at me now. I have my father's old ship, my own crew."
"It's not so powerful as Captain Kidd," he reminded her. Her eyes flashed.
"It was powerful enough to save your life. Now tell me why I should have bothered if you're going to behave with ingratitude."
Drake wasn't in the mood for verbal sparring. "What is it you want?"
"Bluntly, to discuss your cargo and what you plan to do with it."
"What do you know of my cargo?"
"You went to Hot Barsa for a reason. A good deal of effort to run those forts, not once but twice. I assume that whatever risk you took promised some reward of appropriate value?"
"That's my own business."
"Come, don't be so hostile. I only want to discuss it. Why don't you come over alone, and we'll speak one-on-one, and see if we can come to an understanding?"
"Why don't you come here instead, if your intentions are peaceful?" Vargas returned a grin, her teeth white and gleaming.
"Because I don't trust you, James Drake. Last time around, you were shooting my father in the back when he was trying to escape."
"As you might imagine, that incident makes me reluctant to put myself under your power."
"And as you might imagine, the reverse is also true.
You are a known pirate killer. I'm a known pirate.
I'm not going over without some sort of security guarantee.
Very well. How about this? I will leave my shields down and my batteries retracted so long as you are on my ship. As you seem delighted to point out, your vessel, what is it you're calling it now, Blackbeard, is more than strong enough to crush me in a fight. I would assume your crew could manage well enough whether you were on board or not.
Drake stroked his chin, thoughtful. Give me 15 minutes. You'll have your answer then. He cut the link and called Tolvern into the war room to discuss Katerina Vargas's proposal. When the door closed, he turned to find her wearing a scowl so deep it may as well have been sandblasted there.
I don't like it one bit.
Drake sat. I can see that. He gestured for her to take a seat.
So why are we discussing it?
Because she saved us at Hot Barsa. Because she knows something of our cargo. And because she has either bugged our ship or she has someone on board feeding her information. Did you ever speak to Cap?
Tolvern shifted in her seat, looking uncomfortable. I did. First time I went down, she was indisposed. But we had breakfast together this morning. I put the question to her.
And is there a spy on board? Someone giving Vargas information?
Cap was evasive. I think she knows something. Or at least suspects something. I mentioned Carvalho, and she grew especially elusive.
This was an irritating nugget of information, and brought Cap's loyalties into question. If I could end that relationship, I would.
You could kick Carvalho off the crew, but she'd go with him. Then you'd lose them both.
I wouldn't like it, but this current situation is intolerable. Get Cap in here.
Tolvern gave him a worried look. You're sure?
I'm not going to lay out an ultimatum if that's what you're concerned about. In fact, I won't even let on what you told me.
Tolvern fetched Cap, and soon the sub-pilot was sprawled in her seat. Drake asked if Cap's friends and the crew knew what they'd retrieved from Hot Barsa. Sure they do. Can't keep that sort of thing a secret for long.
I would imagine they are writing it off as folly on my part, he said.
Don't see much use in it, that's for sure. We ain't in this out of any charity for the Froom Empire, you know. Plenty of folks are disappointed we didn't loot Malthorn's estate on the way out of there. That's what we were counting on.
I never said we were going to do any looting. If people made that assumption, that's their own fault.
Not like we had much time anyway, Tolvern said. We were lucky to get out of there alive. Oh, I know it. I may have been on the ship the old time, but I ain't blind. He was getting shot up pretty good out there, and the fleet was looking for us at the same time. Don't mean people don't wish we'd taken the time or sent in more people to get the job done. You know those blokes didn't join us on San Pablo so we could run around doing errands for the Froom. Nobody much cares about the antidote, excepting if it gets us a payoff somehow.
Vargas asked me to join her on Orient Tiger, Drake said. Do you think I should go over?
Cap looked thoughtful for a moment before responding. I won't say yes or no, but you'll look like a coward if you don't. What's that supposed to mean? Tolvern said irritably. Keep your shirt on. He's our captain, that's all I mean. We don't want him looking like he's scared. And you know this woman wants something bad, or she wouldn't have gone to all the trouble to pull our stones out of the fire.
Could be revenge she's after, Drake said. I'm still not ruling that out.
Cap shrugged. Yeah, it could be. She don't seem too worked up about her old man, though. I'm guessing it's something else. How about if we go instead? Tolvern said. Cap and I will meet with her, first mate and the sub-pilot. That way she knows we're serious, but you stay safely behind.
Drake gave her a sharp look. If you really think she's up for revenge, then that's the dumbest thing we could do. It wasn't me who pulled the trigger, it was you.
Tolvern thrust out her chin. And I don't regret it either.
Be that as it may, you can bet she knows it too. That she hasn't asked to see you seems to suggest that this isn't about revenge, but just in case I'll go. And I'll go alone.
Captain, no. Whatever she wants, I don't trust her.
Neither do I. But I don't think I'm in physical danger, whatever she's up to.
It's not only the physical danger that worries me.
Oh? What do you mean?
Tolvern dropped her eyes. Never mind. It's just a... I don't know, a hunch, maybe, that it's a bad idea.
I don't follow hunches, Commander. So unless it's backed with rational thinking, I don't want to hear it.
Go ahead, Tolvern, Cap said, studying the commander with a half-smile on her face.
If you got something to say to the captain, you might as well spit it out. No, I don't have anything, Tolvern said hastily.
Don't worry, Commander, Drake said. We'll hold Katerina Vargas to her word. If she tries anything, if Orient Tiger looks to make a run for it, you will blast her out of the sky. Whether I'm on board or not, can you do that? Even if I'm alive.
Tolvern looked uncomfortable, but after a moment of hesitation, nodded.
Will you swear to it? I need the threat to be a real one.
Yes, sir. I will fire on Orient Tiger, and either destroy her or take her captive, should Vargas try anything. I swear it.
Hold her to it, Lieutenant, he told Cap. I'm counting on both of you.
Yes, sir. Drake rose to his feet.
Very well, prepare an away pod. Send a message to Orient Tiger that I'm on my way.
A few minutes later, he was on a pod, soaring the dozen miles between Blackbeard and the smaller pirate frigate. When he was a few hundred yards from his destination, the other ship sent out a netted hook to snag him and bring him in. He emerged from the airlock to find himself facing Katerina Vargas. She looked even more striking in person, with flecks of gold in her eyes and a piercing gaze. Perhaps more handsome than beautiful, but quite interesting to look at. She'd have made a good subject for a portrait, and it took little imagination to imagine her bare arms emerging not from a leather vest, but a fine gown at a ball on Albion. She'd have been sure to cause a sensation as young gentlemen tripped over themselves asking her to dance. The two men standing with her in the corridor were another thing entirely. One had an artificial eye and a scar running from his forehead to his throat. The other was the man with the missing arm replaced by a Gatling gun, who they'd faced in the attack on the spaceyards. It would seem that Katerina Vargas had claimed some of her dead father's crew.
You are taller than I thought, she said.
And you're younger.
I'm 29. How old were you expecting?
Really? You look barely out of secondary school.
Is that supposed to be an insult or compliment?
An observation, nothing more.
In that case, let me observe that you look ridiculous in that uniform. The whole sector knows you're a fugitive from the Royal Navy, so why you're wearing the red and gold as if you still have some sort of rank or status is beyond me.
I suppose you'd have me wearing an eye patch with a Jolly Roger on it, Drake said. Perhaps carry a flask of rum wherever I go. Is that what you'd like, Vargas?
Please, I don't stand on ceremony here. Vargas is my father. My name is Katerina.
You will excuse me, but good manners and good breeding do not permit me to call a strange woman by her given name.
Is that so, James? In that case, does Captain Katerina suit you?
Drake scowled. He had soured on her after that remark about his uniform, and now wanted to get the meeting over with.
Well, here I am. Let's go to your war room and hear what you've got to say.
I don't have a war room.
Then wherever we can talk in private, without your henchmen lurking over your shoulder. Unless you are lying, and these men mean to take me prisoner, in which case I should warn you.
No, you are not a prisoner. I meant what I said. And I do have a private place. Come with me to my quarters. We'll talk there.
Your quarters?
If you're worried that your crew will gossip, feel free not to tell them.
She smiled. Don't worry about my crew. They well know my taste in lovers. There's no real gossip in inviting you to my room. This way. He followed, unsure what she meant. Did her taste run to women, not men? Or was she still going on about how ridiculous he looked in his Royal Navy uniform? Either way, he was irritated that he'd followed her all this way, only to find her playing games. The pirate frigate was perhaps half the size of his own Blackbeard, but you'd never have guessed it by the size of Katerina Vargas's stateroom. It had a sitting room that opened into the kitchen with a separate bedroom and bathroom. The open bathroom door revealed both a bathtub and a shower. The furnishings weren't as luxurious as Admiral Malthorne's quarters on Dreadnought, but it was of equal size. Drake looked around, wondering.
Your crew doesn't complain.
They are too well paid to complain. Each man and woman on board received a bonus of £90 when we put out from San Pablo, plus a promise of a share in whatever booty we take.
If you had that kind of money on hand, why did you attack us at the yards?
That was a point of honor, not money. My father could have counted the loss of Captain Kidd as a hazard of the business and taken this frigate instead, but that wouldn't have satisfied his anger. Besides, I didn't attack you. My father did. Please, take a seat.
She'd moderated her tone now that they were alone, and the insult to Drake's sense of propriety had begun to ease. She pulled a bottle of wine from a rack on the wall and set it in front of him. A wine from New Catalunya, the 04 vintage, which was exceptionally expensive.
I am indeed honored, he said as she returned with glasses and a corkscrew.
I suppose with your breeding you are an expert in wine, but I should warn you to dampen your hopes. The wine is drinkable enough, but the label is a lie. It's no 04 New Catalunya. This was looted from a wine smuggler and counterfeiter. It's really a 27 Mercia.
Ah, that's a disappointment.
Aye.
Nevertheless, the wine was palatable, and his mood continued to improve.
I apologize for being testy. I am grateful for your help at Hotbasa. I was in a tight spot. I won't deny it.
Katerina chuckled.
Your stones were well and truly on the anvil. By the time the Royal Navy finished with you, I expect they would have been pounded to jelly.
You have a strange way with words. One moment you sound like an Albion lady, and the next a Ladino smuggler.
As well I should. My father is a pirate, and my education included finishing school.
How is that so?
Another smile.
Never you mind. Finish your wine. We'll have a pipe together before we get down to business.
And you're not going to attack me because of what happened to your father? Drake asked. That isn't what this is all about.
A shadow passed over her face, but it was gone just as quickly.
On the contrary, I'm grateful to you for that. He was never much of a father to me, and anyway I was tired of obeying his whims. Now look at me, my own ship, no master to order me about. I'm like you, James, free and unencumbered. We are lords of space, our realm endless.
For being lords, we sure fled Hotbasa in a hurry.
Drake took the offered pipe and pinched out tobacco from the silver dish.
My realm is my ship, and even there my rule is tenuous.
Katerina leaned back in her chair and lifted the pipe to her mouth. A smoke ring hovered above her head, slowly dissipating. She studied him with a penetrating gaze, and he got the impression that she was about to get to the heart of the matter.
I look at you, sitting stiffly in your navy uniform, and I have one question for you, Captain James Drake. Are you still hoping to return to the navy, or are you ready to turn against your former masters once and for all?
Chapter 13. Drake didn't answer the question right away. He took several puffs on his pipe before he was ready to respond.
I am still loyal to Albion, he said at last, and as soon as she offers the olive branch, I will return to service.
Pretty words, but I hear a caveat in your tone, Katerina said.
I do not see anything in Albion's behavior that would indicate such an offer will be made, and I find myself at odds with the current Lord Admiral, who I believe to be corrupt and wicked. I harbor some hope that the Crown may intervene, or perhaps old friends in the Navy may assert themselves on my behalf, but those hopes are fading. Do you have some specific proposal to make?
Two proposals, actually.
I'm listening.
There's a shipment of Tyrillium ore on its way to the Hrume world of Res 2. The Empire is trying to rebuild its fleet and needs the Tyrillium for armor. It's a Ladino ship out of Peruano, all perfectly legal. But this particular operation is planning to do some slaving on its way back out. Don't ask how I know, but it's true. The inbound cargo is extremely valuable, and the ship is armed and escorted.
You want me to help you seize the Tyrillium as loot, he surmised, and are using as justification that the merchants are engaged in the slave trade. Why would that matter to me?
You attacked a merchant ship to retrieve your pilot who had been enslaved.
A mission which largely went awry, and most of the slaves were killed in the fight.
So you are not against the slave trade?
It is a pernicious evil, he said.
but I have not made it my particular mission in life.
Oh? And what was it you retrieved from Hart Barsa?
Yes, let's talk about that. You claim to have bugged my ship, but it's a curious device that sends back not just my location, but my motives for moving to that location.
The device is on your bridge and records your conversations, she said.
So your device is large enough to open a subspace channel and send through a stream of audio data? That beggars the imagination. In fact, I'll wager that you have no such device on board.
Tell your engineers to look again.
Let's not insult each other by dancing around what we both know to be true. There is no device. You have a spy, plain and simple.
Supposing I do, does that materially change the facts of the situation?
Katerina set aside her pipe to let it smolder and die.
This proposal benefits the both of us. We'll work together to seize the Tyrillium ship. You have more muscle, but I have located the target, and I will fence the goods once taken. I think a 50-50 split is a more than generous offer on my part.
Drake couldn't believe that simple piracy was her entire motive. Orient Tiger may not be the match of either Blackbeard or her father's old ship, but it was certainly capable of ranging about space preying on lesser prizes. She didn't need to charge after armed and escorted merchants in the company of her father's killer.
You said you have two proposals.
Oh, James, don't sound so suspicious. Here, have some more wine. No? Maybe some music will take the edge off. Do you like classical music?
I do. What do you have?
Everything I can pirate,
Katerina said with a wink. She pulled out her hand computer and set it to something early and baroque.
The person I intend to sell the Tyrillium to is another Hroom, she continued. A middleman on one of the core Empire worlds. If we can surprise the merchant vessel and take it intact, it will be able to jump itself through. But the trip will be dangerous, what with your friends having started another war. And I've heard hints that the Hroom are having trouble in their core systems.
You mean internally? A sugar rebellion?
I don't know. My contact says there is fighting, that's all I know. Perhaps a civil war, perhaps something else. It's the inward flank where humans are forbidden. Everything I've heard is third, fourth hand. But never mind that. I've been promised an unbelievable sum of money if I can get my cargo to my contact.
Define unbelievable.
Over 200,000 guineas. Pay our respective crews, then take our captain shares. That's £40,000 apiece, assuming we survive, of course.
He let out a low whistle. An unpleasant thread of greed tugged at him.
Lords of space, indeed. I could buy an estate the size of my father's with £40,000.
I would have thought Albion real estate to be more dear.
It is a small estate, he admitted, on one of the lesser Zealand islands.
My ambition is greater than to retire in comfort on Albion. But never mind that. You would be travelling deep into Hroom territory. If you wish to distribute this object you took from the Lord Admiral's estate, this would be your opportunity.
I haven't decided yet, he admitted.
Drake hadn't yet heard word from his new science officer. Brockett was still setting up his lab and needed to be sure he could successfully replicate the antidote with existing equipment.
What does your pilot think of this? She asked. He's a former sugar eater. He must have strong opinions.
He is eager, Drake said. No, more like anxious. Going deeper into Hroom space might put him off for a spell while I figure things out.
What is there to figure out? Either you wish to free the Hroom or you do not.
Either we will have human domination of the sector, or I will give that privilege to the Hroom. That is what is at stake, Katerina. Imagine if I break the sugar addiction in the Hroom race, and the Empire regains its former vigor. There are billions of Hroom. We'll be crushed.
She shrugged.
Space is vast, endless. The Kingdom of Albion isn't my concern. There is always another planet, another place to colonize.
Drake had finished his pipe and was back to drinking wine, even though he couldn't recall asking her to fill his glass. In spite of every instinct to the contrary, he was enjoying himself. Not just the conversation, but looking at Katerina Vargas.
She was a beautiful woman. "I've left this region of space," she said. "Twice, in fact, and in this very ship. The first time was after a disagreement with my father. In short, he was being a tyrant again. I hired a crew and set off for Earth."
"Earth?"
"I didn't make it, of course. Too many wars, too many lawless systems, even natural hazards to work around, black holes and gamma bursts. I did meet two ships from the original home system, though. Paid a fortune for a shipment of genuine old Earth scotch. When I finally limped home, I sold the scotch for two fortunes. The money and a bottle of the good stuff was enough to earn me back into my father's good graces."
"And the other time?"
"A few months ago, during the most recent war, word had it that a big Albion fleet was on its way to San Pablo to invade and occupy the Hurum continent."
"That was a feint. We were really attacking the Empire port at Kif Lagoon."
"Yes, well, it worked. As a feint, I mean. An Empire fleet showed up, and those of us with common sense decided not to stick around and see how it would play out. My father was recovering from battle injuries, and I was commanding Captain Kidd. I'd got my hands on an old Hurum chart and discovered that some of the jump points were still active. Thought I'd get out there and have a look around while things were too hot in the known systems. That was thrilling. First week out, we narrowly escaped the jaws of a space leviathan. Then debris battered the hull when we stumbled into an uncharted asteroid field. We blind-jumped twice and were attacked by an unknown ship. Some alien race, not Hurum. Fortunately, its weapon systems were more primitive than ours, and it had already been mauled in some other battle, so its shields were weak. We destroyed it and hauled in bits of its wreckage. Sold that later to the Royal Navy, who are always curious about who else might be out there. By now my crew was on the verge of mutiny," Katerina continued. "I'd lied to them about where we were going, thinking we'd find something useful to plunder before they were on to what I was about. Only we hadn't. Just some worthless alien tech from the derelict. My father came out of the sickbay to discover us 60 light-years from the nearest known system. God, was he angry. You ever been keel-hauled by your own father?"
Drake's father was a gentle, even indulgent landlord, who had trouble evicting tenants late on their rents, even when they'd gotten themselves in trouble by borrowing money for gambling debts. "No, I can't imagine such a thing."
Katerina unzipped her vest and pulled it down off her shoulder. Scars marred the flesh on her back, and he winced at the sight. She shrugged the vest back up over her shoulder. "You see why I wasn't so upset when your commander shot him in the head. Yes, I know it was Tolvern who pulled the trigger. A pirate's life deserves a pirate's death."
"Is that how you intend to go, die in battle?"
"I don't intend to go at all," she said with a smile. "I'm going to make contact with some ancient and wise race of aliens that has discovered the secret to eternal life. Isn't that every spacer's dream?"
"Not me," Drake said. "I would rather go peacefully, not fighting the inevitable. Leaned back in a chair, in front of a peat fire on some cold and drizzly winter night, wearing a warm robe and a comfortable pair of slippers, an old sheepdog asleep at my feet, my last glass of wine drained by my side, my last pipe still smouldering."
"Ha, I don't believe it."
"You don't?" he asked, smiling.
"Let's start with that ridiculous bit about the robe and slippers. You're a man who sleeps in his uniform, am I right?"
"Usually my underwear, actually. I like a cold bed and warm blankets."
"And a warm body next to you? Does that figure into your plans?"
Katerina leaned forward as she said this, her hands steepled in front of her face, her index fingers against her full lips. His mouth felt dry. She laughed.
"That look! Don't worry, James, I'm not coming on to you."
"I was wondering." He leaned back, affecting more nonchalance than he felt. "Then I remembered what you said about there being no gossip in bringing me to your room, that I knew I was perfectly safe in your company."
"I wouldn't say you're as safe as all that. In another time, under other circumstances, I would throw you to the floor and ravish you."
She hesitated, and Drake thought maybe she really would make an indelicate suggestion in spite of her protests to the contrary. What's more, if she did, he was half inclined to take her up on the offer. He was not so eager, however, as to suggest such a thing himself. Physically, he had no qualms.
He'd been perfectly frank with Tolvern about his own desires with respect to women, even if those desires were largely theoretical in nature. In fact, under other circumstances, Jess Tolvern might have been in some danger of his attentions herself. She was clever, loyal, and not unattractive. But Drake was her commanding officer, and she was the daughter of his father's steward. No doubt she would have been horrified to know that such a thought had crossed his mind. Her disapproval of the fraternization between Henny Cap and Rinaldo Carvalho was well known. As for Katerina Vargas, there were no dangers of association, and the woman exuded sensual appeal. He could easily imagine the taste of her skin, the feel of her lips against his, unzipping that vest so his hands could range along her bare flesh. Drake cleared his throat.
I should be returning to my ship.
So soon?
Was your proposal sincere?
Completely.
In that case, I accept, but I have terms.
Such as?
Our two ships comprise a fleet, and there can only be one flag officer. No lords of space, only one person at the helm. That would be me.
You don't know where we're going, she said.
You will tell me. My pilot will chart a course and you will follow. When we enter battle, you will do as I command at all times. The moment you disobey, we are no longer allies.
Her face darkened and her eyes flashed with anger. Is this how you behaved in the Royal Navy, as a tyrant?
Not a tyrant, no, but a dictator. Every man, woman, and hrum under my command will obey my dictates. That is the natural order of things and the key to our survival in hostile waters.
I am not used to being dominated, James Drake. You understand this? It is not my natural way, and I chafe at it.
He nodded, not unsympathetic. Any good leader felt the same. I understand. And you have the ability to choose, right here and now. You've asked for my help, and I'm willing to give it. But if there is to be an expedition, I will make the ultimate decisions.
You may have the superior ship, Katerina said, but you flatter yourself if you think you have superior judgment.
Be that as it may, it is my judgment I trust, not yours nor anyone else's, except perhaps that of King Bartholomew himself. These are my terms. Do you accept them?
Whatever prize this woman was reaching for, it overcame her natural pride, her headstrong personality, because he could see a change sweeping over her features. Her defiance dissipated. Submission replaced it. Drake suspected that her father had seen that same look as the two of them wrestled for dominance, and she had temporarily capitulated. Yes, sir, Katerina Vargas said, and there was no defiance in her tone. You will command, and I shall obey. Chapter 14 Tolvern found herself drifting away from Captain Drake after he made his arrangement with Katerina Vargas. He'd returned to Blackbeard, claiming that he was now the master of Orient Tiger and her crew as well as his own ship, but he seemed preoccupied with the pirate captain, consulting her more often than Tolvern thought necessary, and studying whatever Smythe could dig up from the fleet archives about the woman and her father. And over the next week, he grew more distant as the two ships picked their way through neutral systems on their way to Empire-controlled territory. When Tolvern engaged him privately in the war room, he mainly wanted her analysis of Captain Vargas's motives. What did Tolvern think? Was Vargas toying with them, or did she mean what she'd claimed about the Tyrillium barge? The two ships engaged in piracy along the way, sacking a sugar smuggler on its way to the Empire. Against Vargas's wishes, Drake dumped the sugar into the void, but kept the contents of the ship safe, and dropped the crew itself in a new Dutch colony. It was a lunar mining outpost, and Drake decided it would be a good place to replenish supplies and put in for light repairs. They sold the captured merchant ship before leaving the colony. One night, back in space and between jumps, Cap approached Tolvern in the mess with a confession. Leaning in, breath smelling of rum, Cap admitted her worry that Carvalho had been the one to tip off Katerina Vargas.
I didn't say nothing before Hot Barca, Cap said, 'cause
I didn't want the captain to leave me on the planet, know what I'm saying? Then when Orient Tiger came in shooting, and I seen how she saved us, and I thought it wouldn't hurt to find out what Vargas wanted.
Inside, Tolvern was steaming and anxious to rush out to wake the captain and tell him that she'd discovered the traitor, Carvalho, the wretch. How dare he? But she wanted to be sure before she made accusations.
"Did Carvalho actually tell you that?" she asked. "Or are you guessing?" "Good as confessed it to me. That bloke never was patient, but I thought we should have waited longer before losing faith."
Cap drained her cup.
"Guess it don't matter no more, though, since we're all on the same side now, us and the pirate lady."
It certainly did matter, and Tolvern wasted no time in finding the captain once she left the mess. She went straight to his room and rang. The door opened. Drake sat in his reading nook with a book open on his lap, but he wasn't reading. Instead, he studied a view screen that he'd opened, with a view of near space. Over the past day, they'd been overtaking a comet that now sat some 50,000 miles off starboard, its long, brilliant white tail stretching across the whole of the screen. Tolvern told him what she'd discovered. He scarcely looked away from the comet.
"Captain," she prodded, "did you hear what I said?"
"Yes, I did."
"And?"
"Katerina already told me," he said. "Carvalho wasn't happy with the pace of our piracy. I dare say he's happier now that we've made an alliance with these cutthroats."
Katerina, not Captain Vargas, her given name. No doubt the woman had told Drake to call her that, had probably called him by his given name as well. Tolvern felt a pang of jealousy at the erosion of her intimacy with the captain. He'd asked her to call him James, but only when they were together and off duty. She had taken it as a great honor, had even briefly entertained hopes that it would lead to something else. Now that honor was tarnished. How could he speak Katerina Vargas's given name with one breath, as if they were dear friends, then call her a cutthroat with the next?
"If you knew already, why haven't you done anything?"
"What can I do about it?" he said. "Dump Carvalho at the next port and find someone else? He's doing a good job in engineering. And Cap would leave, too, and we'd be short a sub-pilot."
"You have to do something."
"Flog him, keelhaul him. Is that really my style?"
"I don't know, something. You can't let him disobey you like that. That's not your style either. At the very least, send him out to scrape barnacles for a couple of shifts."
"We don't have any. Rodriguez gave the hull a good shine before we left San Pablo."
"You know what I mean."
Drake turned back to the viewscreen. "There's nothing to be done for it. We're in league with these people now. We have to conform to their ways, and that might mean relaxing discipline."
"I can't believe you're telling me that. You don't really believe it, do you?"
"No, I guess not."
There was still something in his tone that she didn't like, and she stayed silent until he looked up at her, then said, "Is everything okay, Captain?"
"Yes, fine. Sorry. I am distracted."
"About what?"
"Katerina Vargas is coming over here. Yes, I know, I haven't told you. Sorry, but I needed to figure it out myself first. Make sure I really wanted to see her."
"Whatever for?"
"She claims she has new intelligence about the escort for this Tyrillium barge we're hunting, and she wants to discuss it in person. Apparently, we're not the only ones with a spy on board. Or so she fears."
"I don't understand," Tolvern said.
"If she has a spy, if other pirates know we're hunting for the Tyrillium, then it makes sense to be careful about communication."
"And that's all the reason you're bringing her here? You're trying to keep our cause a secret from the two crews?"
"Yes, pretty much."
"I beg your pardon, sir, but I don't entirely believe you. You seem unusually troubled."
Drake sighed. "It's this piracy business. Time to face the truth. I'm one of them. I'm a pirate. The last attack confirmed it. There was no other story I could tell myself. Nothing about rescuing slaves or stopping pirates myself. It was an unprovoked attack. We took no damage and deprived people of their livelihood. Sold their ship for profit and distributed prize money." The attack on the sugar smuggler had been rather uneventful, certainly compared to the fights with Captain Kidd, Vigilant,
or the orbital fortresses at Hot Barsa, but Tolvern could see why it might bother him. Yet she wondered if there were something else.
"Have you decided what to do about the antidote?" Tolvern asked.
"I have." A nervous tickle worked at her stomach.
"And?"
Yesterday, word had come from Brockett in the science lab that he'd replicated the sugar antidote for the first time since leaving Malthorn's laboratories on Hot Barsa. He'd administered the antidote to their room pilot, and the captain had saved aside a few grains of sugar from the captured smuggler ship so he could test the antidote's efficacy. Not yet, of course, as he needed to be sure they could spare Nib Pym for a few days in case it didn't work. They'd need to put the room back in the isolation cells for another round of detox. But Brockett was confident.
"And I'm going to make Nib Pym very happy," Drake said. "The Kingdom of Albion, the entire human race, not so much."
"I see."
"What choice is there? This sugar antidote can secure the freedom and survival of an ancient civilization whose crime is a weakness of biology. If you see an alternative, please let me know."
The thought of delivering such a thing into the hands of the enemy chilled her, but Tolvern couldn't argue with him on moral grounds. Practically speaking, it seemed like a disaster, a hurricane, whose full force might take years to gather. But eventually, it would crash against Albion and leave devastation in its wake. Tolvern was in her room, dressing for bed, when Cap came to her door, asking to come in. The ensign had sobered up in the hour and a half since they'd been drinking together in the mess, and was now wringing her hands nervously as she entered the room.
"I shouldn't have said that about Carvalho," Cap said when the door had closed, leaving them with privacy in the tiny room. "Please don't tell the captain what I told you. It was a mistake."
"I already told him."
"King's balls!"
"Drake already knew. Varkas had told him there was a spy. Told him who it was, apparently."
"He knew it was Carvalho and everything?"
Cap released a string of milk-curdling oaths.
"I didn't even know it was true myself, not for sure. Maybe Carvalho didn't mean nothing by it. Or maybe they asked him to spy, but he didn't. Why would Vargas tell on him? Don't you want a spy on board anymore?"
"She doesn't need him," Tolvern said glumly. "She has the captain now, and he tells her everything she wants to know." Cap studied her face, then sat next to her on the cot.
"What do you mean?"
"What the devil are we doing out here?"
"Pirating, freebooting, if you like it better. I got paid £50 for my share of the haul from that smuggler we took. That will buy a lot of grog, Tolvern. They say we're going after a bigger prize now. Could be 10 times that much. Could be I send my mama a couple of £100 so she can buy that cottage she was dreaming about."
"Will you stop and think for a moment? We're already in room territory. A few more days and we're on our own. We get in trouble. There's no safe port to put into."
Cap shrugged. "A pirate's life. Gotta risk something to get something."
"Following Katerina Vargas, who has reason to see us dead. How do we know she isn't looking for revenge?"
"Seems Drake and Vargas have patched things up after the death of her old man. Must not have cared for the bloke much in the first place."
"Did you hear that she's coming over here?" Tolvern asked.
"Katerina Vargas? What for?"
"Private meeting with the captain," Tolvern said.
Cap raised an eyebrow at this.
"How private?" "Oh, shut up. It's nothing like that. He's a gentleman. He'd never be seen with the likes of her." Tolvern delivered this last bit with more uncertainty than she'd intended, and Cap seemed to pick up on it.
"I heard that. You're not sure, are you? You think he might be hot for the pirate lady?"
"No, I'm not sure," she admitted. Damn it, she was not. "He told me the other day that he was lonely. I'm afraid he's going to fall prey to the first aggressive female who comes his way."
"That was your permission, right there, Commander. Should have jumped him yourself before he changed his mind."
"Now you're being ridiculous. He would have laughed me out of the room. And anyway, I don't think of him that way."
"Sure you do."
"I do not," Cap shrugged.
"Keep telling yourself that if it makes you feel better."
"Even if I did, and I don't, it's a ridiculous premise on the face of it. My father is a servant on the Drake estate. You're from the city, you've seen the lords and ladies about.
Do they mix with their servants? Do they marry among the staff?
So now you're aiming to marry him. That's a bird with a different plumage, love.
You're missing the point.
I ain't missing nothing. You're telling me that the captain is too good for you in one breath, and in the next, saying that he fancies Katerina Vargas. And don't give me that rubbish about fraternizing. You know that don't matter no more. Maybe the captain still says it, but he ain't serious when he does.
I suppose you think I should come on to him. Do you realize how humiliating it would be if he turned me down?
A pirate's life, Cap said. Gotta risk something to get something.
Tolvern was in the middle of her sleep cycle when the captain called her to the bridge. She was up, yawning and pulling on her jumpsuit before she fully realized she was awake. Drake's voice had been tight and urgent, and she didn't so much as grab a mug of strong tea before she headed there. She arrived to discover that she was the last officer on the bridge. The two pilots were already in their chairs. Smythe was at his station, Manx stood at the defense grid computer, and Captain Drake sat in the captain's chair, speaking to someone on the comm while he studied the viewscreen. The Tyrillium barge stretched from one end of the viewscreen to the other, its single plasma engine glowing like a small blue star at the rear of the ship. A smaller ship snuggled up next to the nose of the barge, and a second small ship lurked along the belly, like a pair of remoras following a shark, although Tolvern knew that it was the two smaller vessels that had the teeth in this case. They were armed escorts. Had Drake been expecting that? Tolvern took her seat.
How long have we been giving chase?
Since about the time you went to your quarters.
Why didn't you call me earlier?
It was a long-range pursuit, Commander. Did you really want to sit here watching for the last 4 hours as we inched closer?
The captain had a point about the sluggish beginning to such things, but they were nearing the end of that phase. In the void, the initial stages of a battle might flow as slowly as pine sap, but when matters started, they sped up in a big way. Tolvern queried Jane, who said that the enemy was already within range of long-range missiles. So far, none had been fired.
They've refused to surrender, Drake continued, or even to acknowledge that we're hailing them. Vargas thinks they might be approaching a jump point. We have nothing on our charts within 50 million miles and not in this direction at all, but none of us know the system very well.
What are those escorts?
A pair of long-range patrol boats fitted with jump point engines, Drake said. Highly maneuverable in tight quarters, but not usually seen way out here. We'll see how they do.
Drake's plan, as he explained it, was to send in the smaller Orient Tiger to drive off the escorts from the barge. Blackbeard would hunt them down, one by one, and destroy or disable them, while Vargas engaged with the barge's deck guns. They didn't want to fire anything heavy at their target itself, intending to seize its cargo, not destroy it. Drake made another call to the gunnery, then turned to Tolvern.
Get our friends on the comm. Send them after the lead escort first.
She hailed Orient Tiger. Katerina Vargas's smooth, insolent voice came on.
What orders from our lord and master?
Tolvern explained Drake's plan, told Vargas to drive off the lead escort first.
Don't we want to soften them up first? The pirate asked. The captain says they're too close for shooting. We'll risk hitting the barge. It would be nice if he could tell me himself. It's insulting to get my orders via his minions.
Vargas's tone was more sardonic than irritated.
I might plead my case, suggest that I can hit the escorts without risk to our prize.
Tolvern didn't have the inclination to spar with her.
You have your orders. Obey them.
As you wish. The call ended. Vargas's frigate accelerated. While Blackbeard tailed some few thousand miles behind their prey, Vargas brought Orient Tiger alongside the barge and then dove in at the three ships like a wolf trying to drive a calf from its mother. The New Dutch were canny pilots and seemed to recognize the tactic. The front ship merely hugged tighter, while the one at the rear pulled away just long enough to aim a pair of small cannons at the frigate. Vargas was forced to peel away. The barge also engaged her ship with deck guns, and two small explosions lit along Orient Tiger's stern as Vargas retreated to a safe distance. But the pirate captain only pulled back long enough to reorient herself for another charge. This time Vargas swooped in so aggressively
that she was nearly between the front escort and the much larger ship before the other ships could drive her off again. Meanwhile, Drake ordered Blackbeard to close and shoot at the barge's deck gun to see if they could disable it. When they were a few dozen miles away, Barker opened up with the Gatling guns. The barge's deck gun was too well protected to take out, but they managed to draw its fire. The enemy scored a few minor hits. On the third swoop, Vargas came in so tight it looked like she would ram the barge. That would end in ruin. Not only was the barge 5 times the size of the frigate, but her hold was full of Tyrillium. Orient Tiger would smash against it, like a tin can crushed against concrete. Vargas pulled up at the last moment, turning her engines against the hull of the barge to check her momentum. The maneuver baffled the lead escort. It veered to one side to avoid collision, just as Vargas pushed against the side of the barge. The escort was momentarily separated by a few miles of empty space. Before it could come back in again to hug the barge, Orient Tiger shot 2 slow-moving torpedoes into the gap. The patrol boat was forced to peel away. Tolvern stared at the viewscreen, momentarily stunned by the brilliant maneuver. Katerina Vargas was twice the captain her father had been. Drake gave orders to Nib Pym to muscle into the gap and keep the escort away. Never mind the barge's deck gun, or more dangerously, Vargas's torpedoes, now wandering about looking for a target. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And now the enemy made a fatal error. The second escort pulled away to shoot at Vargas's pirate frigate in an attempt to provide cover for the first ship to return safely against the barge. This left it exposed to Blackbeard, now coming up behind. Drake was on the comm giving orders to Vargas, and that left Tolvern to give orders to the gunnery. She got Barker in the gunnery.
"Prepare the main battery. Hit her hard. Ready tubes 4 and 5.
They came up along starboard of the rear escort and forced themselves between it and the barge before either ship seemed to realize they were there. Tolvern gave the order to fire. Blackbeard's main batteries let loose with such power that the ship rocked and the dull throb of the guns shook the floor beneath their feet. The distance was only a few miles, and the enemy patrol boat had thin shielding, sufficient to tangle with typical pirate weapons, but not to stop the main guns of a Royal Navy cruiser. She didn't stand a chance. Lights flared along her side from stern to prow. The plasma engine blew off like an enormous fireworks rocket gone astray, leaving a blue corkscrew that zipped by below Blackbeard, nearly striking them as it passed. The enemy ship gave a little shudder, then blew apart in a final terrific explosion. The other escort fared little better. Vargas had her separated, and the two ships were trading blows when Blackbeard joined the fight. While the gunnery prepared the main battery for another volley, Barker opened up with the smaller belly guns. This was enough to force the fleeing escort back into Orient Tiger's line of fire. A final volley along the ship's damaged side tore it in two. Blackbeard pulled away as secondary explosions blasted apart what was left of the wreckage. Now stripped of its defenses, the barge continued on its way, still refusing to acknowledge any attempts to communicate. Orient Tiger came in on one flank, and Blackbeard the other. Harpoons soon had the ship fixed, and 2 boarding parties set off. The first pirates had just arrived when the new Dutch finally discovered a working communication system and offered a full surrender. Chapter 15. Admiral Malthorn descended from orbit with a corvette and 2 troop transports, each holding a company of Royal Marines. They descended to 50,000 feet above the ocean, then flew west toward Auckland Island, staying out of range of the coastal radar of the other Zealand islands. It was nighttime, and the islands glittered far to the north as they stretched from the continental shelf of Canada and into the ocean. Colonel Fitzgibbons stood next to Malthorn on the bridge of the corvette, already wearing his battle uniform, including polished black boots and black leather gloves. He had a square head, cleanly shaven, except for a bristly mustache and thick eyebrows above dark, penetrating eyes. During the war, the colonel had once leveled a Hroom town of 60,000 when they refused to surrender. He seemed to feel little more sympathy for his fellow citizens of Albion, and had not balked when given his orders. A little brutality was in order.
Malthorn decided. Time to show that he was not a man to be trifled with. Such a demonstration should not have been necessary, of course, given his station in life. Vice Admiral Thomas Lord Malthorn was King Bartholomew's cousin on his mother's side. On his father's, he issued from a line of dukes that had been growing in wealth and power for 8 generations. He was head of the Admiralty, and the king couldn't wage war without him. In fact, it could not have escaped the king's attention that the Lord Admiral was 6th in line to the throne, and that the 5 ahead of him were 2 children, an unmarried woman of 24, and 2 old men. And so, when Malthorn had demanded 2 companies of Royal Marines to put down internal dissent in the Zealand Islands, the king barely mounted a protest, even though such a thing was illegal. One of Parliament's most closely held prerogatives was the control of military power on Albion herself. By law, the military was confined to the barracks and ports, and under no circumstances would the Navy or Marines enter the major cities of Yorktown, Sydney, Chicago, Manchester, nor any of the semi-sovereign estates. Short of an actual invasion from the Hrum Empire, should force be required on Albion, that duty fell to the private armies of the great lords, as well as to a confusing jumble of parliamentary and city militias. Thus it had been for 375 years since the Second Albion Civil War. It was nearly dawn when they reached Auckland. It was a small, insignificant island, some 6,000 square miles of land far out in the ocean. Half of the island remained royal forest, with the rest divided among 3 baronies and several small towns with their own charters and government. A small, rain-drenched range shadowed the more temperate northern plains, where the tenants of Baron Drake raised sheep and cattle, and operated a small coal mine. Malthorn waited until his ships were over the mountains before they descended. The sun rose behind them in the east. "Will the Baron resist?" Fitzgibbons asked. His accent was flat, neutral, spoken like a man who had never lived long in one place, who had adequate education, but could not boast of particular understanding, a military mind, but nothing more.
"Doubtful, but we're prepared if they do."
"And his fellow islanders, they boast a militia of nearly 3,000 in total, should they commit to his defense."
"Easily crushed by the armaments of this ship," Malthorn said. "Backed by your marines."
"More easily still from a distance." The colonel had made this point earlier, while they were still in orbit on Dreadnought. Demand the Baron surrender. Should he refuse, should he resist, the battleship could bombard his estate from space until it was a pile of rubble. Fitzgibbons didn't understand the situation. That was the downside of choosing a man with a purely military mind.
"For a man who has killed so many, you are surprisingly squeamish about spilling blood," Malthorn said.
"The only blood that makes me squeamish is the blood of my own men."
"Of which there will be endless quantities spilled if we do not put down the rebellion."
"Yes, Admiral." Malthorn braced himself for resistance as they flew over the central plains. Dawn's brilliant display might reveal anti-aircraft batteries set up in the estate villages, or men dug in at bunkers behind missile batteries. But the only movement came from bewildered flocks of sheep that scattered in terror at the noise of the heavy craft rumbling overhead, and ranchers on horseback who struggled to control their mounts as their herds stampeded in every direction. Baron Drake's manor and outbuildings soon appeared, the white granite of the house's cupolas and wings sitting peacefully among the estate's modest gardens, and the surrounding hunting forest of maple and elm. It was nicely situated, beautiful and verdant, but Malthorn thought of his own property on Hot Barsa, incinerated by the Baron's treasonous son, and hardened his heart. They landed the corvette on the broad expanse of lawn above the stables, with the transports dropping down on either side. The engines scorched the lawn to brown and boiled off so much heat that a pair of small sheds caught fire. By the time Malthorn and the colonel stepped out of the corvette, the fire had spread to the stables themselves, with flames licking the roofs, crackling, roaring, and spitting sparks. Inside the stables, horses screamed in terror. A stable hand came running toward the doors to unlock them and release the horses, but one of Fitzgibbon's men shot him dead. Meanwhile, the transport was disgorging heavily armed marines.
Some set up a perimeter beneath the corvette's protective guns, while others moved to secure the outbuildings. Scattered gunfire came from the greenhouses. Fitzgibbons strode off to give orders and was soon leading a group of 30 or 40 men toward the main house. That left Malthorn protected by several personal bodyguards and the Lord Admiral's own adjutant. 10 minutes later, Malthorn got the call that the house had been secured. He met the colonel beneath a massive chandelier in the great hall. Fitzgibbons told him that several house servants and personal guards had died trying to protect the family, but that the Baron had ordered a surrender as soon as he realized the futility of his situation, and there had been no further bloodshed. Malthorn strode into the library to find the Baron in his bathrobe, in a chair, the man's gray hair wet and uncombed. The library was a fine room, larger than the manor itself justified, filled with handsome volumes and excellent furniture. Under other circumstances, the Admiral and the Baron might have shared a drink and discussed their shared tastes in books and malted whiskey.
"You were in the bath,"
Malthorn said, amused, as he took in Baron Drake's condition.
"And I was worried you would give us trouble. Where are your wife and daughters?"
The Baron glared back at him and didn't answer.
"If they think to escape," Malthorn said, "they will shortly be disabused of the notion."
Indeed, Fitzgibbon's men soon found two of them and brought them in. The Baroness, a still handsome woman of about 60, came first, wearing a bonnet and a sundress with a floral print, as if ready for a stroll in the gardens. Moments later, two marines led in a pretty young woman with dark hair. She was tall, with a proud look in her flashing eyes that reminded the Admiral of her older brother, James Drake, who had lately caused so much trouble. Both James and his sister resembled their mother. The young woman shrugged out of the grasp of the two young marines, who seemed reluctant to hold her with force.
"Which one are you?"
the Admiral asked the girl.
"Helen or Madeline?"
"This is an outrage," Lady Drake said. "You have killed our servants, destroyed our property. By what right?"
"Say nothing," the Baron told her. "We will hear what charges he brings to justify this insult."
The Admiral ignored them and fixed the young woman with a penetrating stare.
"I asked you a question. What is your name? Answer at once."
"Helen, my lord."
"And where is your sister?"
"Do not speak to him,"
Lady Drake said, her tone as haughty as her husband's expression. To the Admiral she added,
"My older daughter is married these 5 months. You will not find her on the property. Indeed, she is not even a resident of Auckland any more."
"I would like to hear your charges," Baron Drake said. "I would like to know under what pretenses you have attacked my estate and murdered my servants."
"I would not have thought an explanation to be necessary,"
Malthorn said.
"Are you unaware of your son's treason?"
He waved for the marines to get Lady Drake seated. The older woman was agitated, and Malthorn thought she might do something foolhardy. He didn't want any of these people dead. Not today, anyway.
"I am aware that James has been accused of such," the Baron said. "Yet we have not seen him, nor heard from him, since the accusation. I cannot believe it is true."
Malthorn didn't know if the man was lying about hearing from Captain Drake, but the rest of it was disingenuous. Only a parent could view the mutiny and seizure of a Royal Navy cruiser, subsequent fights with other Navy ships, and then an attack on the Lord Admiral's personal property as a mere accusation of treason.
"He most definitely is a traitor, and we have reason to believe you have been aiding him in his treason."
"That's a lie," the girl burst out. "James is a true patriot. He loves Albion more than you or anyone else. He would never do that, and neither would my father."
"Helen," the father said in a warning tone, "you will hold your tongue."
"We are at war, Baron," Malthorn said. "This time, it may be for the very survival of Albion. The Hrum will turn our cities to rubble and enslave our people if we do not resist them. In the past, your seditious behavior might have been overlooked, but not this time."
Lady Drake's face had paled at the mention of sedition.
What are you saying?
Your husband has been aiding the traitor, telling your son where the Royal Navy is searching for him, and bribing naval officers so that they will let him slip out of traps we have set for him.
These are lies, she said. Tell him, Chester, you are innocent of these charges. How could you possibly know anything about traps or bribes?
He already knows I am innocent, Baron Drake said slowly. A look of understanding passed over his face. This is not about us, dear. This is something else. Some private scheme or plot. Some way to get back at James because he remains out of reach. Am I right, Lord Admiral?
Malthorn didn't address this accusation.
Baron Chester Drake, your lands and holdings are hereby confiscated. You will be transported to the Tower of York to be a royal prisoner while you await trial on charges of treason and sedition. The Admiralty will demand, and Crown and Parliament no doubt concur, that you be hung by your neck until dead.
Admiral Malthorn had fixed his gaze on the Baron and his wife, sitting side by side in front of the cold hearth. The Marines had similarly directed their attentions, but now a motion on the periphery caught the Admiral's eye, a sudden movement, the sound of metal scraping on metal. He turned to see the girl, Helen Drake, with a pistol in her hand, drawn from a book with a false center. She lifted the pistol and pointed it at the Admiral, her hand steady, her face calm, a deadly look in her eye. A spike of fear lanced Malthorn's heart. In that instant, he knew he would die, and all because he had been so careless as to ignore the girl, so foolish as to forget that she was a Drake, made of the same material as her older brother. He could see it in the flinty look in Helen's eye, the set of her jaw, the way that she held the gun without fear, her nerves made of ice. Two of the Marines spotted the movement at the same time. The first man threw himself between the Admiral and the barrel of the gun. The second Marine grabbed for the girl herself. Helen's gun fired twice, and each shot hit the young Marine who'd used his body to shield the Admiral. He fell. The second Marine nearly reached her, but she took a step back and fired again. The shot hit the man in the face. Unhindered once more, Helen now turned and calmly pointed her gun back at the Admiral, who had stood frozen in place, unable to move. It had all happened so quickly. And then Colonel Fitzgibbons fired. He had not moved from his spot. Instead, he had drawn his sidearm while others flailed about or stood transfixed. He shot the girl again and again as she fell. The gunshots only ceased when the girl lay motionless, legs twisted beneath her, the pistol falling from her grasp, blood on her chest, and dribbling from her mouth. The Baroness was screaming, fighting against the two men holding her. The Baron raged and cursed, and shortly disappeared under a swarm of uniformed Marines. They kicked and